Welcome to Steppin' Out of Babylon, produced by Sue Supriano. Babylon is everywhere. It's the isms and schisms not only within the system, but within ourselves. Let's unify, stand aligned, and step out of Babylon.
Hi, everybody. I'm Sue Supriano, and this week's Steppin' Out of Babylon show and the next one are going to be different than usual shows because I think the information you're about to hear is so crucial. These shows have been produced by Kelly Ramirez and Bonnie Faulkner for KPFA Radio. They've been shortened a bit to fit into my time slot here. Listen closely to the first half today, and I hope you'll be able to hear the second half next week.
Welcome to Guns and Butter, The Economics of Politics. I'm Kelly O'Ramaris with Bonnie Faulkner. Guns and Butter investigates the relationships among capitalism, militarism, and politics. Maintaining a progressive perspective in the aftermath of the September 11th attacks, Guns and Butter, The Economics of Politics, reports on who wins and who loses when the economic resources of civil society are diverted toward global corporatization, war, and the furtherance of a national security state.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today we're featuring Michael C. Rupert, publisher and editor of From the Wilderness Publications, on The Truth and Lies of 9/11. The following is from a presentation Rupert gave on February 21st in San Francisco.
This is the seventh lecture that I have given in the 9/11 series. I want to leave you tonight with the message that your lives and your liberty are on the line now. There is no more opportunity for armchair discussion. There is no more time. The philosophy with which I started publishing From the Wilderness 4 years ago was very simple. I don't publish anything that I can't document. I don't ask you to take anything that I write on faith. I will offer opinions, and I'll tell you their opinions. I'll give you my analysis. But I don't make any assertions unless I tell you where I got the information so that you can go find it for yourself. And I have taken on some very big names in 4 years. I won't go through the litany. I have never been sued because truth is an absolute defense against libel. Absolutely. All the time. What I'm doing tonight is I'm presenting to you exactly the same way that I would present if I were a detective talking to a district attorney, or if I were an attorney talking to a grand jury. I'm presenting a case with the evidence. I will not speculate. There's a lot of things we're not going to talk about tonight which can't be proven. Were there explosives in the building? Were the airplanes flown by remote control? All these cul-de-sacs that you can't go into, that I can't produce proof for, I don't care. They're irrelevant. My job is to reach the people out there who haven't been reached with those facts that shake the foundation of their belief that they're the fundamentally most blessed people on the planet, enjoying a standard of living because God loves Americans above all other peoples in the world, which is what George Bush sells. I have to shake their belief in the system, and you don't do that with speculation. Now, there's some things that I have to tell you before we start talking about September the 11th. If you don't understand these things, you will never understand completely why September the 11th happened. One is drugs, and the other is oil. If you're in the U.S. government, in the executive branch, and somebody working under you commits a crime, there is a law in Title 18 U.S. Code that says you have to turn in your employees if they're committing crimes. You have to call the Justice Department, you have to call the FBI, and report the criminal activity. Well, they knew that. It's a law. So they had a negotiation. In this negotiation, which was between William French Smith, which you can barely read down here, that's Reagan's first attorney general, but you can read, boy, there's an oxymoron, the Honorable William J. Casey, Director of Central Intelligence, in view of the fine cooperation the Drug Enforcement Administration has received from CIA No formal requirement regarding the reporting of narcotics violations has been included in these procedures. Let me let that sink in for a minute. The Attorney General has just notified the head of the CIA that he no longer has to tell the Department of Justice when his people are dealing drugs. There it is in black and white. Proof of a conspiracy, right there. By the way, do you know who negotiated this memorandum for William French Smith? Ken Starr. Now, there's one reason and one reason only why the CIA deals drugs. Not to fund covert operations, not to make George Bush rich, but to support the U.S. economy. June 27th, 1999, New York Stock Exchange chief meets Colombian top rebel commander, Bogota. A guy by the name of Dick Grasso flies to Bogota and meets with the FARC guerrillas. Now, everybody knows in Colombia, right? Everybody deals drugs, right? Everybody, left, right, center, government, paramilitaries, they all deal drugs. And what Dick Grasso said when he was meeting with the FARC commander was, will you please invest your drug money in Wall Street? That's what he said. It's in the story right there. He didn't say drug money, but he said, let us manage your funds. And it's, you know, everybody knows the only way that FARC makes money is by taxing the cocaine trade. Black and white. Didn't hear that on Peter Jennings, did you? Okay, so he's asking for money to Wall Street. And you know what the FARC guys told him? They said, no, senor. A year later, President Bill Clinton announces Plan Colombia. You know, and we since displaced 2 million people from their homes by spraying glyphosate from Monsanto. And we're spraying food crops, of course. And we're just driving the cocaine production onto lands controlled by the paramilitaries. And we're getting ready to go to war in Colombia again because there's oil there. But let's stay on the drug theme for a minute. In January of last year, Senator Carl Levin of Michigan, author of a minority report from the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations on Correspondent Banking, and this is a copy of, this is the first page of the report. I just wanted to show you what the report looks like. If you go down at the bottom, it says, inattention by and disinterest by U.S. banks in screening the foreign banks they take in as clients have allowed rogue foreign banks and their criminal clients to carry on money laundering and other criminal activity in the United States. And yes, that's true, and to protect the narcotics industry. And then if you read the report a little bit further, it says J.P. Morgan, who was, by the way, the largest creditor of Enron, Bank of America, Citigroup, and First Union are laundering all this drug money. It says down here, $1 trillion laundered annually. That's from the U.S. Senate. And it says $500 billion through the United States banking system. The rest of it's going through Wall Street. The current regime, the current empire, and we are an empire now, get that straight, has crossed a line of criminality from which it cannot turn back. It has no alternative now but to proceed apace until it imposes a full dictatorship, a full fascist state, because the level of criminality is so out of the closet, they just don't care anymore. But I saw this back in May, when Citibank, Citigroup, by the way, who's on the board of directors at Citigroup? John Deutsch, the former CIA director, Robert Rubin of Goldman Sachs, former Secretary of the Treasury, a woman named Nora Slatkin, the former CIA executive director, that's the number three position. They paid $12 billion to buy Banco Nacional de Mexico, Banamex, second largest bank in Mexico. It is an overt, open drug money laundering bank in Mexico. So overt that a brilliant Mexican newspaper named Por Esto wrote a story about 2 years ago about the bank's owner, Roberto Hernandez. He owns most of the Yucatan Peninsula. In fact, the natives refer to it as the Cocaine Peninsula. There's landing strips all over the place. There's refueling for boats. And they published all this documenting that Hernandez was a major drug trafficker. By the way, in August of 2000, Bill Clinton vacationed for 10 days on Hernandez's property. President-elect Vicente Fox, the first day after winning the election, paid a courtesy call on Roberto Hernandez. Roberto Hernandez shared a media consultant with George W. Bush. Hernandez now sits on the board of directors with Robert Rubin, John Deutsch, at Citigroup. They don't care if you know how criminal they are anymore. They are laughing at you, and they hold the rest of the American people in utter contempt. Let's take a little look at CIA and Wall Street. The National Security Act of 1947 was written by Clark Clifford, an aide to Harry Truman, longtime Democratic Party powerhouse. He wrote the act that created the CIA. Who can tell me what his profession was? Wall Street lawyer and banker. As a matter of fact, Clark Clifford is the American who brought the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, BCCI, onto American shores. Okay, BCCI was a huge drug money laundering bank. Now, the CIA was designed for Clifford by two brothers, John Foster and Alan Dulles. John Foster was Secretary of State under Dwight Eisenhower. Alan Dulles was DCI, get used to the term, Director of Central Intelligence, DCI, from 53 to 61. John Kennedy fired him after the Bay of Pigs. What was their profession? Wall Street lawyers from the firm Sullivan and Cromwell, the most powerful law firm, wouldn't we agree on that, on Wall Street. By the way, who are Enron's attorneys? Sullivan and Cromwell. Okay. Bill Casey. All right, most of us are old enough to remember Iran-Contra. What was Bill Casey's job for Richard Nixon? He was chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission. Stanley Sporkin, retired recently as a U.S. District Court judge in Washington, D.C., CIA General Counsel in the 1980s. What was his job before he was the CIA General Counsel? He was General Counsel of the SEC. David Daugherty, who was the CIA General Counsel after Stanley Sporkin. Anybody know what he does now? You're going to love this one. Executive Vice President of the New York Stock Exchange for Enforcement. And a guy by the name of A.B. Buzzy Krongard. A.B. Buzzy Krongard is currently the executive director, or ex-DIR, at CIA. The top three positions are DCI, Director of Central Intelligence, DDI, Deputy Director for Intelligence, and Executive Director, ex-DIR. The current executive director of the CIA. What was his job before he went to the CIA in 1998? CEO of Alex Brown, or A.B. Brown, a major investment bank. Remember that. By the way, does everybody agree that I've presented a case that there is a very deep, long-standing relationship between the CIA and Wall Street? As a matter of fact, six of the first seven DDIs of the CIA came directly from Wall Street to the agency. I thank my dear friend Peter Dale Scott over in Berkeley for pointing that out. Zbigniew Brzezinski, National Security Advisor to Jimmy Carter, trustee and founder of the Trilateral Commission, international advisor of several major global corporations, associate of Dr. Henry Kissinger, under Ronald Reagan, member of the NSC Defense Department Commission on Integrated Long-Term Strategy, under Ronald Reagan, member of the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board. This guy is everywhere on both parties, which is where you have to go to solve this. If there's anybody in this room who thinks that just by throwing the bushes out, this is all going to go away, go home and take some lithium, buy a straitjacket, and get yourself out of my way. If you want to get really mad, go out and buy this book. It's called The Grand Chessboard, American Primacy and Its Geostrategic Objectives by Zbigniew Brzezinski, written in 1997, 4 years before the first plane hit the World Trade Center. 4 years. We're going to look at some selected and very fun quotes from this book. He said, as we move into the end of the age of oil, as we move into a new world order, as we move into the 21st century, as the whole world changes, whoever controls Eurasia will be supreme. He talks about, in this book, maintaining U.S. primacy. He talks about China, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan. The largest untapped reserves of oil and natural gas in the world are right here. We couldn't build a pipeline out through Russia because the Russians knew that if they had the pipeline, they could control it and tax it. They could threaten American control, and they could move south to control all of this. And what's been on the table has been a long-planned pipeline to be headed by Unocal, built by Halliburton, the feasibility studies done by Enron, to be built from here straight down to the Pakistani coast. Now, the crying demand for oil now is in China, the Far East, which has an exploding economy needing energy. The plan is to build a pipeline and to transport it around to China and Japan. And, of course, to take whatever we need for U.S. use along the way. Now, let's look at some quotes from what Brzezinski had to say in 1997. Bear in mind, every word of this was written 4 years before the World Trade Center. The public supported America's engagement in World War II largely because of the shock effect of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. For America, the chief geopolitical prize is Eurasia, and America's global primacy is directly dependent on how long and how effectively its preponderance on the Eurasian continent is sustained. America's withdrawal from the world, or because of the sudden emergence of a successful rival, would produce massive international instability. Maybe we would call that democracy. In that context, how America manages Eurasia, do we manage countries? Is that our job? Manages Eurasia is critical. Now, here's a quote that this has kind of become a tradition as I do this. We did it for a joke in Portland, but it's really caught on, and so I'm getting to like this. But I absolutely have to read with a German accent. Never before has a populist democracy attained international supremacy. The pursuit of power is not a goal that commands popular passion, except in conditions of a sudden threat or challenge to the public sense of domestic well-being. The economic self-denial that is the defense spending and the human sacrifice, I love that human sacrifice, casualties even among professional soldiers required in the effort are uncongenial to democratic instincts. Democracy is inimical to imperial mobilization. One lesson I learned a long time ago, what the gods would destroy, they would first make ludicrous. We must learn to laugh in their faces sometimes. I haven't done this yet. I should maybe do this one in a British accent. This just seems to fit better. To put it in a terminology that harkens back to the more brutal age of ancient empires, the three grand imperatives of imperial geostrategy are to prevent collusion and maintain security dependence among the vassals, to keep tributaries pliant, and to keep the barbarians from coming together. Referring to an area he calls the Eurasian Balkans and a 1997 map in which he has circled the exact location of the current conflict, describing it as the central region of pending conflict for world dominance, Brzezinski writes, "The Eurasian Balkans are a potential economic prize." Now, there is an old saying that I have learned from the intelligence community, God equals gold, oil, and drugs. In Afghanistan, we have all three. Where was the first place we sent military troops after September 11th? Uzbekistan. I got news for you. We were already there. Had been for some years. Training, preparing. Now listen to this very closely. An Islamic revival already abetted from the outside, not only by Iran, but also by Saudi Arabia, is likely to become the mobilizing impulse for the increasingly pervasive new nationalisms determined to oppose any reintegration under Russian, hence infidel, control. Now, let me tell you a secret. The United States has created Islamic terrorists and Islamic fundamentalism. The reason we have created all of these groups was to keep Russia from getting anywhere near the oil in the Middle East and in Central Asia. A long-term plan. China's growing economic presence in the region and its political stake in the area's independence are also congruent with America's interests. China is totally behind this because they can't build a 5,000-mile pipeline. Halliburton can. Without sustained and directed involvement, before long, the forces of global disorder, democracy, could come to dominate the world scene. And the possibility of such a fragmentation is inherent in the geopolitical tensions, not only of today's Eurasia, but of the world more generally. Clearly, He saw Russia as the prime contender. And let me tell you how long this war was planned. During the decade of the 1990s, thanks to Al Gore, Victor Chernomyrdin, the Harvard Endowment, Goldman Sachs, the U.S. Treasury, the World Bank, and the IMF, under a very precisely orchestrated plan, Harvard and Goldman Sachs had the exclusive contract to teach the Russians how to become capitalists. And we looted, the United States looted $300 billion out of the Russian economy over that 10-year period. When the Soviet Union ceased to exist, the population of Russia, that was one of the republics, was about 164, 65 million people. When I was in Russia a year ago, the population was 145 million people. The life expectancy of the average male in Russia is 48 years. There were stories documented in Moldavia and outlying areas of Russia that people were selling flesh from human cadavers as fresh meat because there was no food. This is the Hubbert curve, or an extrapolation, widely recognized, widely accepted throughout the energy industry. Oil is a finite resource. Can we all agree on that? All oil production always follows a bell curve. When you drill your first well and you hit a gusher, so you get so much oil, then you drill more wells and you reach a peak of production over the life of an oil field. And then eventually the oil goes down further, you go into what's called secondary recovery and you got to pump in water. And eventually it takes more energy to pump out a barrel of oil than you get from burning it. And that's when the field is essentially dead. There are new methods, you know, but there's no way to change that. World oil production will peak in the year 2006, never, ever, ever to be exceeded again. After that, world oil production will diminish. This is a line right here that shows that roughly around the year 2004-5, world hydrocarbon consumption per capita, the lines will cross, meaning that suddenly there's going to be conflict, there's going to be scarcity. But look at the line of population as it increases long after world oil production peaks in 2006. As demand is increasing, oil is becoming scarcer and scarcer. Remember that electricity, most of it comes from natural gas, which is the Siamese twin of oil. Plastics, fertilizer, jet fuel, car fuel, all comes from oil. This is inevitable. This is going to happen. And if you go a little bit further, we have another chart here that shows world oil production will peak in 2006, but the oil fields in the Middle Eastern countries, the members of OPEC, will peak last. In other words, it's inevitable that we're going to run out, but whoever runs out last wins the game. Following this model, this war that Dick Cheney says will not end in our lifetime starts to begin to make sense, doesn't it? Because the strategy will be, we have some reserves in ANWR, the Arctic National Wildlife Animal Refuge, but the United States will use its resources last by going around the world and controlling the rest of the world's oil resources, because the scientific research says that when you get to a point where there's 11 billion people, there's going to be maybe 5, 6, 7 billion too many people on the planet. And for the first time, although I've been seeing some evidence for years, I am beginning to suspect that these fools might have made a decision. Well, it's not the problem that there's too little oil, there's just too many people. The congressional investigation of September 11th will be a total whitewash. It's been placed under the control of Britt Snyder, the former CIA Inspector General, who covered up Volume 2 of all of the CIA's drug dealing in Iran-Contra after the Gary Webb stories came out. He is a class operative. He's very familiar with me because I was a part of that investigation. I was not allowed to testify. Gary wasn't allowed to testify. And Volume 2 of the CIA's Inspector General report, I publish excerpts from that. These are edited by me. You read this, and it says clearly that the CIA dealt with 56 known traffickers, kept 8 out of jail, briefed Vice President Bush on how they were lying to Congress. There's telling CIA documents showing that one guy with his weekly shipment of 220 kilos of cocaine, a telegram came from CIA headquarters, do not debrief the man, let him go. CIA's own records. That's what Britt Snyder overlooked as Inspector General of the CIA. He will do the same thing in the congressional hearings on September the 11th. Hold no faith in those hearings. Before I wrap up, the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act is a pending bill which Health and Human Services has now introduced successfully into 24 state legislatures. It has been passed already in the state of Kentucky, and it's being enacted as a state law the same way they enforced the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit. The Health and Human Services is saying we're going to withdraw our federal funding for Medi-Cal and Medicare if you don't pass this law. This law makes it a felony to refuse a vaccination when ordered by a state government. This law makes it a felony to refuse any medical treatment ordered by a state or local government. This law allows state and local officials in cases of declared medical emergencies to seize any private property without recourse, compensation, or any hearing, condemn it, or appropriate any private property for use during any medical emergency. No trial, no nothing. This allows any state or local agency to quarantine, seal off any neighborhood, evict anybody from their home, stop all water transportation, put people in any kind of lockup they choose to. It's already been passed in Kentucky. Let's look at what's going on here. Since October the 4th, the largest outbreak of an Ebola-like virus took place on the Afghani-Pakistani border. 75 people. Wonderful quote in here. The doctor says, you watch the patients melt in front of your eyes. This was dated 7 October, just after the attacks. The British are digging up 10 victims of the deadliest disease ever to hit the planet, the Spanish flu, to get the DNA, just in case it ever outbreaks again. Get this. The U.S. government has requested 300 million smallpox doses. The contract's been let. A company called Acambus is fulfilling the contract right now. How many people have had a smallpox vaccination? Weren't we all told that it was good for life? But how scared do you need to be? You remember what you heard tonight and that you're responsible for doing something with it.
That was Michael C. Rupert, editor and publisher of From the Wilderness Publications. He spoke for 4 hours in San Francisco on February 19, 2002. It was produced for radio by Kelly Ramirez and Bonnie Faulkner. If you'd like more in-depth information, you can go to Michael C. Rupert's website, which is called FromTheWilderness.com. There you can order tapes and get also written information. Hope you can hear the second half of Michael Rupert's speech next week on Stepping Out of Babylon. I'm Sue Supriano. Thanks for listening.